We've not forgotten any human rights activist in the Soviet Union who is being punished or imprisoned. The recent exchange was a result of long and tedious and detailed negotiations, extending, I would say, at least over a six-month period. The final agreement was approved personally by me and, I presume, by President Brezhnev. The identity of the human rights activist who came here from the Soviet Union was one that was a subject of detailed negotiation, where the Soviets would put forward names and we would assess those names and repeatedly reject them because we did not think they were adequate. In my final judgment, reached just a week or so ago, I felt that the list of names was a fair exchange and therefore approved them. And I cannot tell you any more detail than that about the negotiations. Yes, sir?
Have you considered taking your SALT case to the public next year to try to get a Senate that would approve the treaty?
No, I have every intention to conclude the SALT negotiations at the earliest possible moment. No one has ever seriously considered, in my administration, to my knowledge, any slightest delay in concluding the SALT treaty for political purposes or for any other purpose. And my understanding is that if the SALT treaty can be concluded fairly early, that it will be considered as a very top priority by the Senate, and the action by the Senate will be concluded this year.
Mr. President, how do you respond to the statements by Jim Fallows, who was your chief speechwriter for more than 2 years, on a number of things, but specifically that while you hold specific positions on a number of individual issues, that you have no broad overall philosophy about where you'd like to see the country go? And on another point, Fallows says that you signed off personally on the use of the White House tennis courts, but you told Bill Moyers that you didn't. What's the truth about that?
Let me say, first of all, that I think Jim Fallows is a fine young man. And he didn't express these concerns to me while he was employed by us. This is a kind of question that has to be faced by any president when someone leaves the White House. It's happened many times in the past. Jim Fallows and I agree on most things. His assessment of my character and performance is one of those things on which we don't agree. And this is unfortunate, but understandable. He left the White House employment with a very good spirit of friendship between me and him, and with no insinuation that there were things about which he was disappointed. The White House tennis court. I have never personally monitored who used or did not use the White House tennis court. I have let my secretary, Susan Clough, receive requests from members of the White House staff who wanted to use the tennis court at certain times, so that more than one person would not want to use the same tennis court simultaneously unless they were either on opposite sides of the net or engaged in a doubles contest.
President, you have said frequently in the past that you wouldn't hesitate to point out people, organizations that are not complying with your wage and price voluntary guidelines and that you think are helping to add to inflation.
That's right.
Yet, if I'm not mistaken, I have not heard you do so yet. Can you today tell us any organization, any labor union, any company that you think is letting the American people down in this regard?
Every week since we have had our voluntary wage and price standards in place, I have had a meeting with my top economic advisors, an early morning breakfast meeting once a week, at which time we discuss in some detail the degree of compliance both of the top businesses of our nation and also the important unions of our nation. I think the last report that we had was that there were 13 companies who may or may not be in or out of who may or may not be out of compliance. We have inquired to the executives of those companies, telling them about our concern. This is done through the Council on Wage and Price Stability. We then give them a chance to respond, either to justify their price, which we think might be too high, or to change their prices if we can demonstrate to them that their prices are indeed too high. Last week, when we had this meeting that I'm describing now, there were four companies that we thought were out of compliance. The only one that we were sure had not at that time achieved compliance was Sears. I called executives of Sears and pointed us out to them, told them that I had seen the data, and in my opinion, they were not in compliance. They asked for a chance to meet again with the Council on Wage and Price Stability personnel, and they modified their prices to come into compliance. I do not know at this point of any company where we can prove that they are out of compliance because they modify their prices or either convince us that they indeed are meeting the guidelines. Wages, this is a voluntary program, and I do not want to get involved in wage negotiations. Only Wayne Horvitz, who is the federal mediator, is authorized by me to do so. But we make our position very clear when a major wage negotiation is approaching, that we consider this or that demand to be either within or not within the guidelines, and we let this position be known publicly. I think that this is the proper procedure, and we will continue to do so. It has applied in the case of the Teamsters. It's now applying in the case of the rubber workers. It will apply in the future in the case of the United Automobile Workers. And when they are doubtful about whether a particular proposal does come within the guidelines, they make an inquiry. But neither I, nor the Secretary of Labor, nor Alfred Kahn, nor Barry Bosworth gets involved in the actual negotiations themselves. We're doing the best we can. It's not perfect, but I think we've made a great deal of progress.
Mr. President, Senator Kennedy, in his speech this afternoon before the American Society of Newspaper Editors, says that you have been intimidated by the oil lobby into throwing in the towel on price decontrol without a fight, and that your proposed windfall profits tax is but a token that is no more than a transparent fig leaf over vast profits by the oil industry. Do you think that's unfair, that criticism is unfair?
That's just a lot of baloney. I really can't believe that Senator Kennedy said this unless the phrases were taken out of context. Because everyone knows who's in the Congress that decontrol is mandated in the present law, controls to be terminated in October of 1981. This is not a decision that I made. I am complying with an existing law. And in order to minimize the impact of decontrol, we are carefully and slowly phasing out controls over roughly a 28-month period. I have made a proposal to the Congress, which in my judgment is eminently fair. It lets the oil companies keep 29 cents out of every dollar of increased revenue which they derive from decontrol. As I said earlier in this news conference, if the Congress, including Senator Kennedy, wants to tighten up on that windfall profits tax with their proposals that I consider to be fair, I will gladly support such more stringent windfall tax proposals. I will not support any move in the Congress to make the windfall tax more lenient on the oil companies. But I have a responsibility as president to make the best judgment on what needs to be done in the future and to comply with the federal laws when I make decisions for the present. And I'm always amenable to proposals made by Senator Kennedy or anyone else to make the laws fairer or more stringent if the Congress thinks they should be made more stringent.
Mr. President, on Capitol Hill today, a number of Republican senators who say that they are uncommitted on SALT II were critical of Admiral Turner, the Director of Intelligence. They claim that he has been making speeches around the country in support of the treaty, and they feel that he should not get involved in what may become a partisan issue. What is your understanding of Admiral Turner's role? Is he an advocate of SALT II, and if so, is this your direction?
No, I've never asked him to make any such speech. I think, as is the case with almost every major official in the federal government, in the executive branch at least, they are called upon to make speeches on matters of great moment and importance to the people. Even in the case of the CIA director, responsible for intelligence, he's not confined just to expressing an opinion on collection techniques, most of which are highly secret in any case. I don't know what comments Admiral Turner has made. I happen to know that he's basically in favor of the SALT treaty. I might say, to get back to the previous question about the Congress attitude toward the windfall profits tax, this is not an easy question to address, but we've made a lot of progress in the last 2 weeks. When the windfall profits tax was first mentioned, when I started talking about it back in April, there was an almost unanimous opinion expressed on Capitol Hill that no windfall profits tax could be passed. And those of you in the media reported these comments. And now some of those very same people who said that it was not possible for a windfall profits tax to be passed at all are now quarreling about whether we should take from the oil companies 29 cents out of each dollar or 25 cents or 24 cents or whatever. But I think we've made great progress in the last 2 weeks in selling to the American public and therefore to the Congress the need for the windfall profits tax, just because I have spoken out strongly and fervently and with deep feeling on the subject. So we're making good progress. And I'm eager to work with the Congress on how to make my proposals even better.
Yes, President, among the inflation figures, the most stubborn seem to be those of food, fuel, and housing. And those also seem to be the least susceptible to controls of any kind. Is there no hope for progress in this area until those prices become so high that people can't afford the things they really need?
There is some hope in the area. Fuel, to a major degree, is affected by oil prices established by an international cartel, over which we have very little control. However, we can reduce our dependence on foreign imported oil by the implementation of a sound national energy policy. I've worked on that for 2 years. In food, I would say one of the major leading items in food price increases has been beef. And every agricultural economist, every farmer knows that the main cause for high beef prices is sustained high demand and very low sizes of American beef herds. It takes 5 or 6 years to slowly build up your breed cows and then to have an increased herd to produce more beef. One of the causes of the present shortage was the price controls imposed upon beef under the Nixon administration. And at the time, the farmers sold their brood cows and heifers instead of keeping them for future beef production. Pork, because of its short gestation period of swine, and poultry, with an even shorter period of increase in production, can be increased fairly rapidly. And I've been very pleased at how fast those two items particularly are being increased. The production of fish for American consumption is a slower process because it depends upon the habits and the number of fishing boats and fishermen available in that industry. So I think we've got a good prospect in the future for food prices to drop somewhat, or at least the price levels not to rise so rapidly. This past winter and the previous winter, coincidentally, were two very severe periods of adverse weather. And this additionally affected food in the case of perishable vegetables and fruits. Housing. We have had in the last 2 years a rate of housing construction of over 2 million per year in spite of high interest rates and high prices. And this has provided an increased demand for lumber, for plywood, for insulation materials, and for all other building materials that go into home construction. Recent statistics unfortunately show that the rate of construction of housing is dropping off. This will decrease demand if the trend continues to be less than, say, 2 million per year. And we are trying within the federal government to increase the rate of production of timber. So although we don't control these three items that you mentioned, there are elements that we can now detect that indicate some hope for the future after several months go by. Yes, sir.
The Israeli cabinet has recently approved two new settlements on the West Bank. In the light of the enormous cost to the United States of implementing the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, isn't it reasonable to expect the Israelis to cease from the settlement policy, which violates international law? And secondly, why should the American people pay for policies of the Israelis that undermine the peace process and run counter to American foreign policy?
Well, the position of the United States historically has been consistent. And my own position on settlements in the West Bank, Gaza area, and on the Golan Heights, and in the Sinai, my position has been consistent. The Israeli government knows perfectly well, after hours of discussion on this issue, what my position is. We do consider the creation of Israeli settlements in these areas as being inconsistent with international law. And as I've said many times, they are an obstacle to peace. Knowing that, the Israeli government still, on occasion, authorizes new settlements. They interpret the law differently from myself. I hope that the Israeli government will severely restrain any inclination, either approved by the Knesset or done without legal sanction, in establishing new settlements. But there is a limit to what we can do to impose our will on a sovereign nation.
President, the administration position on the Rhodesian election has been until now that you are assessing the situation. Can you tell us, though, however, whether you personally are inclined to lifting sanctions against Rhodesia, recognizing the new government there? And if you do that, what impact do you think that will have on your Africa policy? Won't it be cause you severe troubles for what you've been trying to do on that continent?
I'm constrained by the law to wait until after the new government is established before I make a decision on whether or not the recent elections have been adequate, in my judgment, to lift the sanctions. And we are now going through a very careful process of assessing the conduct of the elections themselves and also the consequences of the election. I'm not going to comment any further on it than that, but I will say that we have not varied our position that the government of Rhodesia ought to be established through democratic principles. The election should be held with all parties willing to vote or run for office being permitted to do so, and that this should be based on one person, one vote principle. We have worked in consonance with most other Western nations, also, far as I know, and closely with the British, who have a legal responsibility for Rhodesia. We have kept the United Nations informed, and I think that our position is a proper one. But after the new government is installed in office, at that time, I will make a judgment under the Case-Javits Amendment and decide whether or not I think the elections were enough progress toward those principles that I've just described to warrant the lifting of sanctions. I cannot make that judgment at this time.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.